You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights, down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie for Solidarity Breakfast. And hello, Matt. How are you?
Great. It's great to be here this morning. Annie, I actually saw, on the way in, I actually saw one of those balloons.
Oh, isn't it wonderful?
Yeah, lovely.
Oh, it's a great experience.
Yeah, just as I was coming up on the drive along St. George's Road. Yeah, it was a nice start to the morning.
Yeah, nice start to the morning. There's this fabulous sensibility from seeing those balloons flying across, or floating across. There's been a really lot of stuff happening over this week, but one of the news-breaking events happening overnight was that Turkiye has put out an arrest warrant for... Go on, your story.
Yeah, I found out about this quite late last night, about 11 o'clock. I saw a headline on the New Arab, and then I saw it reported again on the Middle East Monitor. Turkiye has applied to Interpol for red notices for arrest warrants to be issued against Benjamin Netanyahu and I understand other Israeli ministers. And this is in relation to the members of the Samud flotilla. Listeners may recall that the last mission had left from Turkiye. And obviously when they came back, you did hear the accounts of all the abuse, torture and sexual assaults are brought against them by the Israeli forces. And you may recall that when they were ejected from Israel, they did return back to Turkiye. And it's highly possible that they were examined by medical physicians in Turkiye. So that's probably the basis of the arrest warrant application.
Yes, very interesting. APAN breaks down some of the issues that have happened this week, of course. This week in Palestine, a relentless escalation of violence, dispossession and destruction saw Israeli occupation forces alongside settlers carry out more than 467 attacks against Palestinians in the illegally occupied West Bank in just week. Human Rights Watch's new report documents that Israeli settler attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank have displaced 107 communities since January 2023, stating settlers shoot, attack and expel Palestinians from their land and the state provides the weapons, the legal cover and the budget to do it. The Israeli government coming closer to home, the Israeli government announced there will be no criminal investigation into the Israeli drone strike that killed Zomi Frankom, an Australian humanitarian aid worker, and six of her colleagues. Foreign Minister Penny Wong must expel the Israeli ambassador, says APAN. Words of condemnation are not enough. There was some positive news coming out of England around the court cases, the Palestine Action Jury discharged in Albert Bristol. You know about this?
Yeah, this has been ongoing for some time. The activists in Palestine Action that did damage to an Albert factory, I believe, located in factory in Bristol. They were subject to a whole lot of charges of terrorism. There's a lot of legal debate that perhaps they should have been at least charged with causing acts of criminal damage, not terrorism.
Oh, and in fact, there was some argy-bargy where the jury came back with this. They did cause damage. And then they were told that they were actually being charged with terrorism, and which is an outrage.
It's an outrage. And also in that same case, the barrister defending them was trying to instruct them about their rights as a jury and was admonished by the judge.
Hmm.
And I understand is also facing legal sanctions, but that's another story. But what's happened here is that the jurors have actually announced that they're not going to announce no convictions for the seven defendants.
Yeah, well, see, as I said, a good piece of news.
That
there.
Is a good piece of news. It's great news.
There were some interesting things coming. There's always interesting things coming out of America, but this is a positive story. Angie Nixon scores socialist breakthrough in Senate race in Trump's Florida. Do you want to pick that one up?
That's quite an interesting story because the takeaway I took from that was there's still. Obviously, Florida is a very strong Republican stronghold, and this is a race to determine who's going to run as a Democratic candidate. But what's really interesting is that she does come from a Labor background.
And also the amount of money that her campaign had was overshadowed by her main rival, 1-6.
Yeah, 1-6, like her main rival is something like $45 million, I think, and her campaign, I read some accounts said her campaign was about $60,000. And I think this really underscores not so much money, but what the importance of grassroots and campaigning, that can be really effective to turn the tide. So let's hope that this augurs good news in the upcoming primaries as they go.
Well, there's elements to what's going on in America that really does give you the impression that ordinary Americans are going to have to fight for their country back. The Center for American Progress talks about, gives a pretty interesting précis of America's connection to the war in Iran. 6 months ago, the Trump administration promised swift success when it launched a war with Iran. Instead, the administration dragged the United States into a widening Middle East quagmire with no clear path out, and Iran has emerged as the strategic victor. More than 50,000 US troops remain deployed in the region, 18 service members have been killed, and nearly 500 service members have been injured. And Americans are paying the price at home. The broader cost of the war, including military spending, higher interest rates, the higher prices for gas, groceries and transportation have topped $1,200 per household. Now the administration is asking Congress for another $73 billion to fund its failed war. That's $73 billion US dollars. And the other part of what the Center for American Progress was sending out in its latest release was something that sends shivers down your spine, or my spine anyway. The Trump administration's heavy-handed approach of using the National Guard in combination with other federal law enforcement surges has alienated local communities. No amount of legal intimidation or all-caps social media posts can erase the facts. The Pentagon's recent extension of the controversial deployment in Washington, D.C. through Inauguration Day 2029 proves that Trump sold to the public as a temporary response to a fabricated emergency has now been codified into an open-ended, multi-year federal mobilization in our nation's capital. creepy stuff.
It's really disturbing.
They're going to have to fight to get their country back.
Yeah, I think we're already seeing signs of that, where it's been going on for months with the local actions against ICE abducting people off the streets.
Yeah, and also weirdly coming out of the US have imposed sanctions on two judges from the International Criminal Court on the grounds, and this is inverted commas, protecting the safety of Americans. Not one American has ever faced charges by the ICC. The USA does not recognise the jurisdiction of the ICC. And I suppose that's kind of... Is a bedfellow of the news that Americans have now illegally started setting up a drill in Greenland for oil, apparently.
Yeah, well, there probably is a direct connection, but it's just an extension of what I remember some comments that Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, said about 2 weeks ago, that they were going to take action to demolish the ICC. So, look, it's a broader campaign. I mean, I recall...
A lawless international scene.
A lawless international scene, but I've got a long memory, and I recall the background to when the Americans invaded Iraq, and there were discussions then about the jurisdiction of the ICC. So for a long time, the Americans have been against this institution, which is built to try to bring political leaders to account and individuals when they commit gross war crimes, obviously, and breaches against international human law.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's a reflection that people who do these criminal acts on large scale actually don't like people knowing that they're evil people.
Yeah, interesting. That.
It's an interesting concept, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think...
You'd think that they'd stand by their actions.
Well, I think another aspect, important takeaway is, we're probably all aware that Francesca Albanese has also had sanctions imposed on her, and she has spoken at length about the impact on her personal life. You can't basically function. Most transactions in the world go through US banks. You wouldn't be able to get a credit card, take cash out of the ATM, pay for things by FPOS. In fact, I recall that Francesca Albanese has said that she's had to depend upon her adult daughter
and husband
to help her out in that regard. So
yeah, no,
it's really disturbing. It really is.
It is. There was a really interesting and weird thing. We'll go out with that because we've got today we're the last of the breakfast shows that are going to be focusing on AI specials. Later in the program, in the last half hour, we're going to be highlighting some conversations that were held at a NIB Arena event as a backgrounder, and it's our contribution to Science Week, because it's Science Week this week. And, science can be good. Science is good.
Science is good.
Let's
folks.
Wave the flag for science.
Rationality.
Rationality.
Scientific method.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we'll talk about my last little story after a couple of local stories: unemployment rising, and ACOS, the Australian Council of Social Service, say that there are better ways of dealing with inflation than sacrificing over 100,000 people to poverty social security payments. You'll find that Kevin's got something to say about that in This Is the Week That Was. The other thing, which is actually a win, more local in Victoria, the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, BALS, reports that last week Greens member Catherine Copsey successfully passed an amendment to the Corrections Act in the Victorian Parliament, which will see the harmful practice of decanting made illegal. This means that police will no longer be able to transfer someone in their custody from one police station to another, overriding the 14-day legal limit in police cell custody. Who would have thought? Outrageous stuff, isn't it? Look at the fine print.
Yeah, what can you say?
Yeah, what can you say? Insane. The last little story, which I preempted, which is that The Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which comes out of England, names the source of AI generator rapper used by right wing, claiming it is just free speech art project. The two men behind Danny Bones, the AI-generated rapper who has become a prominent voice in Britain's online far right, can be named for the first time. Denver Barber, a music producer and sound engineer from Greater Manchester, and Theo Blackledge, a 3D artist and animator from Liverpool, are the founders of the Node Project, the previously anonymous collective behind Danny Bones. Danny Bones is a white nationalist rapper whose videos show him driving a deportation van through London, railing against the Islamification of Britain and asking whether the world is run by Jews or the Master Masons. The videos have clocked up millions of streams, and his head breakout song, This Is England, topped the iTunes hip-hop charts. In May, he appeared on screen at the Unite the Kingdom rally, introduced by Tommy Robinson as an ally in his war of propaganda. But these two little toe rags are going around saying it's just a free speech art installation.
No, it's not. It's obviously propaganda.
Yeah, that's right. You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Matt, and we've got plenty of things to talk about this week, but you might want to have a look at what your future holds this evening.
A Friday Rave and Yabai Hi-Fi present Political Rudical, a 3CR Radiothon fundraiser. Join us at Bar 303 on High Street in Northcote on the 22nd of August from 7 p.m. A night of roots and dub music powered by the almighty Yabai Hi-Fi. A lineup of local sound system heavyweights on the decks. Striker D from Hardicle High Power, Joe Dubs from Solidarity Sound System, H and Jack from Goody's Hi-Fi, Lego, Martha, DJ Curly from 3CR's Cultural Kinetics, Degenerator, and Yabai. Hear from Joe Dubs on the politics of sound system, and of course a rave from Jacob and Mercedes. Tickets are $15 and can be found at ra.co by searching Political Rudical, or check out Yabai Hi-Fi and 3CR on Facebook or Instagram. Political Rudical, a 3CR Radiothon fundraiser, 22nd of August from 7 p.m. at Bar 303 in Northcote. There's a tram stop right out the front. A 3CR supporter.
And you're with Annie and Matt on Solidarity Breakfast, and we're going to go to some voices for Palestine. This was taken, these voices are from the 2nd of the August rally, and these are a couple of voices from the conveners of that particular rally.
What's your name? My name's Renee Nayef. I'm one of the conveners of Students of Palestine here in Victoria.
Moayed Ali from Free Palestine, Melbourne. Today we are focusing on the West Bank, Gaza, prisoners, everything that actually Israel attacking at the moment. Our people in Palestine, in the South Bank, in Msafer Yatta, in the villages surrounding Nablus, Jenin, Tul Karim, everywhere in the West Bank, everywhere in Gaza being targeted. Yesterday, Israel killed 8 innocent people in Gaza. They bombed Al-Aqsa, Shuhada Al-Aqsa Hospital. They bombed a tent that contained consumables and equipment for dialysis. People who need those equipment that been donated for them to stay alive. That cannot be continued. It's clearly a genocide ongoing in Gaza and in the West Bank, and that has to be stopped. That's why we are focusing on everything, including their prisoners.
Yeah, we're here today to stand against the genocide that is continuing in Gaza. The hundreds of thousands dead, we're here to stand in solidarity with them, to condemn the ongoing atrocities being carried out by Israel with the support of our government here in Australia, the Labour Party, who have remained steadfast in their commitment of support with Israel. We're also here to condemn the wide-scale military offence carried out by Israel in the West Bank. The settler violence at an all-time high in villages in the West Bank. Israeli settlers carrying guns, massive guns around their backs, going into Palestinian villages, carrying out campaigns of terror against Palestinian villages and families. So we're here to stand against that. Also to stand with the people all over historic Palestine under... experiencing, facing Israel's genocide, but also the people all across the region, in Iran under Israel's bombs, in the south of Lebanon where my family's from, under Israel's bombs. So we're here to fight for the people of the region, but also to condemn our government for their despicable complicity.
Okay, what do you think of Trump's announcement that Hamas is has agreed to disarm? Do you have any comments about that?
I think we can't trust a single word that comes out of Donald Trump's mouth. It is absolutely outrageous. This is the man who has called for Gaza to become a Riviera of the Middle East, to sell it off as real estate. We are months and months and months into a so-called ceasefire in Gaza. And what have we seen? A ceasefire in Lebanon and thousands dead, not to mention his ongoing despicable war on Iran, which has murdered thousands of people, including hundreds and hundreds of young school children. So we don't trust anything that Donald Trump says, anything that comes out of the mouths of any of the imperialist, disgusting politicians in America and Australia. And we stand here with the people of the region.
Because the Palestinian fight isn't just the Palestinians' fight, it's all our fight, because it's a fight not just about land, it's about a fight for freedom.
Everybody should be standing here today saying, free Palestine.
Solidarity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters on behalf of the Gumbanja Nation, my people who've never ceded their sovereignty.
We should be recognising Palestine as a state and recognising the rights of Palestinians.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
We're going to go to Dandenong now. I went and recorded the anti-racist rally that was held there last Sunday. And of course, Dandenong's a fantastic place because it's absolutely full of people from a whole lot of different places. And the rally was started outside Dandenong Market. And if you haven't been to Dandenong Market, you're missing it. You're missing out because it's probably one of the best markets I've ever been to. I went in and did some vegetable shopping. I was very pleased. It was great to be there, to tell you the truth. And this speech is because people are feeling very upset, of course, about the One Nation, Hanson, divisive approach to politics. They have a completely different understanding about what Australia is, and that they're part of the fabric of Australia. This speech is just absolutely fantastic.
Our first speaker is Samar Giet. She is a communications coordinator and wellsprings for Women in Dandenong Anti-Racism, and is leading anti-racism projects, led community developed advocates, and she was born in Lebanon to Sudanese Egyptian parents. Please make her feel welcome. Thank you, Samar.
Thank you, Hero. Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming today. I, too, would like to start by acknowledging that we are meeting today on the Bunurong land. And I pay my respect to their elders, past, present, and emerging, as we gather to stand against racism and discrimination. Let us remember that the first peoples of this land have shown extraordinary strength and resilience in the face of generations of injustice. Their ongoing journey reminds us that the fight against racism is not new, and that building more just, inclusive, and respectful Australia is a shared responsibility. May we honor the responsibility today through our words, our actions, and our commitment to standing together against hate in all its forms. Always was, always will be.
always was, always will be. When I arrived in Australia in 2009, I was excited to begin a new chapter of my life. And at one of my first jobs as a customer service person, a client asked me, "So, did you come here by boat?" There's nothing wrong with coming here by boat. But his was not a normal question. It was a reminder that before he saw me as a person or a worker, he saw me as someone who did not belong. And over the years, there have been many moments like that. Some were subtle, others were impossible to ignore. Then, just recently, racism reached my own daughter, who was only 8 years of age at then. And she's here with me today. She was about to walk into the school stage to perform. It should have been one of those moments that every parent treasures. And instead, another student called her an ape. An ape. As a parent, hearing those words broke my heart. I have become used to the slurs and the subtle racism over time, but to witness racism reach its tentacles to my children hurt me deeply. But this is not only my family's experience with racism. These are the stories of countless people in our communities. I stand here today not only as an Arab Australian, but as someone who has spent the past years working with multicultural communities and advocating against racism. Through my work, I have listened to and documented incidents experienced by people from many, many cultural, racial, and faith backgrounds across Melbourne's southeast. Behind every report is a human being, a mother, a father, a young person, a neighbor, a colleague, a friend. I have met women who no longer feel safe leaving their homes wearing a hijab because they fear it will be pulled from their heads. And it did happen. Women who have been verbally abused while shopping, threatened on trains and buses, discriminated against at work, made to feel unwelcome when trying to access community services that exist to support everyone. I spoke to mothers who are terrified that their children will experience the same racism they have endured. And sadly, many did and still do. The effects of racism don't end when the abuse stops. People lose confidence. People become anxious. People avoid public places. They withdraw from community life. Some stop participating in education or employment opportunities. Some begin questioning whether they truly belong in the country they call home. That's what racism does. Research consistently shows that experiencing racism can impact mental health, like increased anxiety and depression, social isolation, and reduced trust in institutions, like the police. This is not simply about hurt feelings. It's about health. It's about safety. It's about people's ability to participate equally in society. And racism is not only interpersonal. It's systematic, it's structural. It exists when people face barriers because of their name, their accent, their appearance, their faith. It exists when communities are constantly portrayed as problems instead of partners. It exists when political rhetoric encourages fear instead of understanding. When politicians, I don't want to name names because we know them, blame migrants and refugees for society's challenges, those words don't stay inside Parliament. They reach our schools. They reach our workplaces. They reach our streets. and sometimes they become permission for someone to abuse a stranger. That is why we cannot stay silent. Today, many people in our Arab, Muslim, and multicultural communities are carrying enormous grief because of the devastating war in Gaza, if we can call it war. It's a genocide. And the violence affecting Lebanon too. Many of us have family members, friends, and loved ones living through unimaginable suffering. Many of us are grieving while we're also facing increased racism and hostility here in Australia. No one should have to carry both. No one should have to carry any. We must reject every attempt to divide our communities. We must reject the politics of fear. We must reject attempts to scapegoat migrants, refugees, and minority communities for political gain. And we must stand together whenever anyone is targeted because of who they are. Being anti-racist means standing beside Aboriginal Australians. It means standing beside Muslim Australians when they experience Islamophobia. It means standing beside Jewish Australians when they experience anti-Semitism, while recognizing that legitimate criticism of the government of Israel, including criticism of its actions and apartheid policies, is not anti-Semitism. It means standing beside African Australians, Asian Australians, Pacific Islander communities, and every person who experiences racism, because dignity is not something that belongs only to people who look like you. It belongs to everyone. Australia's diversity is not our weakness. It's one of our greatest strengths. Every culture, every language, every faith, every story, we make this country richer. So today, I ask something of every person here. When you witness racism, do not look away. Support victims. Challenge prejudice when it's safe to do so. Teach your children that diversity is something to celebrate, not something to fear. Help create schools where every child feels safe. Help create workplaces where everyone is respected. Help create neighborhoods where no mother is afraid to walk her children to school because of what she is wearing. My hope is that one day my daughter will not have to tell her own children stories like those ones. That they will grow up in an Australia where no child is called an ape because of the color of their skin, where no one is asked if they belong because of where they come from, where every person can walk through life knowing they will be treated with dignity, fairness, and respect. That Australia is possible, but only if we build it together. Thank you.
Yeah.
And you're back with Annie and Matt on Solidarity Breakfast, and that was Banshee Land by Pixies. And we've got Sarah Bartola on Dolo on the line. G'day, Sarah. How are you?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good as well. And, of course, you're getting yourself all geared up for the 22nd annual Green Left comedy debate, aren't you?
I really am. I'm very excited about it.
Yes, that's right. It's on tonight. It's at the Brunswick Town Hall in Sydney Road, and it starts at 6, but the actual debate starts at 8. Can you tell me how you got roped into this?
Well, I did it last year, which was super fun, and they reached out and asked if I would like to MC, and I'm always open to giving my time and my talents for the cause. And then I actually roped in all the other comedians. So,
so who have you roped in?
Okay, so we have a stellar lineup of comedians, all based in Nam. Maren May, Baha Dubba, Rose Bishop, Amna B, Lauren Edwards, and Simran Pastricha. And they're all incredible comedians. They're all very vocal about everything that's happening. And that was really important to me, to have people on the lineup who were political and who use their comedy for, to spread the word.
Yeah, it's great fun, isn't it? It's great to be able to be on a stage with an audience that's on your side and who are really interested in the what you decide to do with the topic.
Oh, 100%. I've always been political, and I've always used my comedy and my writing and acting to talk about what's happening in the world, because I think that's our duty as artists. And I have had gigs where jokes have not landed, not because they weren't funny, but because the audience, you know, it takes a little bit of time, I think, especially for Australian audiences, to get on board with political comedy.
Yeah, they've got to work out which side they're allowed to be on.
I will tell them we spy it.
Well, I was kind of interested in the topic because it's why we should blockade the USA. And I'm thinking there's no negative to that.
Well, you'd be surprised. And I think that's what is going to be so fun about tonight, because obviously the US and so many other settler colony states need to be held accountable for their actions on a global level, but we're so tied to the US, I think culturally, economically. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how the comedians on the negative swing it and make it entertaining.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because it's terrifying.
Totally, but also, I think we can be silly with it in a debate like this. There are so many reasons maybe why we shouldn't, and that's obviously, tongue-in-cheek and satirical, but it's going to be fun. I think it's going to be fun.
I think it is too. And the other thing that's fun about it is that Green Left have created a whole social event, which they've been doing for a number of years, but it's a good, cosy thing to do, to go to Brunswick Town Hall. You can get some food, you're in like-minded company, and then there's a great performance.
Yeah, exactly. And it's I think it's really a cool way to entertain people through a debate. And I think the topic is really interesting. I'm excited to see where the comedians go with it, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so what time should they get there, and when are you going to be on?
I'm going to be on, I'm going to start the debate at 8 p.m. Doors open at 6:30. I would get there when doors open. There's going to be amazing food, and there's going to be a bar as well. And it's just a good opportunity to, as you said, hang out with like-minded people and get into the mood, get a couple of drinks in you, loosen up, get ready to laugh. We love comedians. We love laughter. So I just encourage the audience to be as loud and vocal and encouraging as they can, because we really love it.
Thanks for talking. Really, oh, good. What were you going to say?
I was just saying it makes comedians feel really good when there's laughter.
That's right. Someone got caught the joke.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thanks very much for talking to us this morning, Sarah.
Thank you. You're welcome. My pleasure. Thank you.
We have got something very special. Yeah, up at Camp Sovereignty, Grandmother Moon, Full Moon, at end of the month. Camp Sovereignty presents Rock Against Racism. Remember the Rock Against Racism back in the day? Yeah, so from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m, Sunday the 30th of August, at Camp Sovereignty, Linlithgow Avenue, not the King Domain, Melbourne. Rock Against Racism is a free concert held in honour of all those ready to stand strong against the racist attack on the camp. Come dance and spread the love, hey? Rock Against Racism, 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. on the 30th of August, Grandmother Moon Night at Camp Sovereignty.
The 3CR supporter.
From Fidway Primary School, and you're listening to Community Radio on 3CR.
And you're back with Annie and Matt on Solidarity Breakfast, and that was the wonderful Catherine Trakos, Call the Sun. And we've got one of our compatriots on the line. This is Tabea. We've woken him up. G'day, Tabea. How are you?
Go on, John. No, I'm performing the age-old ritual of fomenting, which is where you put bricks in boiling water to try and banish the fever that's lifting you.
But you've woken up and doing such things because you've got an important message to remind people about the Reservoir Library and the renaming.
That's right, Annie and Matthew and all the listeners. This weekend is the last weekend before Council sits in on the proposal of considering whether to rename the Reservoir Library the Darabin Council, the best council in the world. We'd like to hope consider renaming the Reservoir Library to after Gaetano Zucca for his amazing legacy that he's left the citizens of the northern suburbs and indeed all oppressed people. And so we'll be outside Reservoir Library tomorrow collecting interested people that want to write an email to him, to the council about him, and talking about maybe something that's inspired them about Gaetano and why they think renaming the library to be an important thing to do. We have social media on Instagram and Facebook campaign to rename the Reservoir Library after Gaetano Greco. You can get all the information there. But the most important thing is, I guess, if people can spare maybe 5-10 minutes to shoot council an email that's really all we need to do, and just show Gaetano and his family how important his legacy was to the people of the northern suburbs.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to point out, if it's all possible, that you could attend the council meeting on Tuesday evening at around about 6 or 6.30. And even if you are so motivated and have the time, also suggest that you speak to a submission. What I suggest, people look very closely at the council meeting agenda, item 9.1, and look at that very closely and adhere to the items and that agenda. Because there's an important piece about allocating council budget funding to bring about the memorial.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really nice.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, the significance, of course, of Gaetano, I met Gaetano as a person collecting news. And one of the most interesting things for me as a person who collects news is that Gaetano was staunch. He was continuous, and he was also incredibly open-handed and friendly. So he focused on what he was aiming to do, and he worked with people to do it. And as a person who collected media, I was always blown away by how generous he was in terms of time, and he had absolutely no sense of your importance or lack of importance in the sphere, the world sphere. He was completely open-handed and even with all people. Fantastic. That's person.
Right. That's right, and that stretches into his sort of career working with the council and everything like that. So he was elected mayor of Darwin at one point, and he even forewent his mayoral car and his extra allowance, redirecting all those funds into aged care, into caring for council, keeping aged care as a council service, as well as many other projects like the widely popular Save the Press the Market campaign, the campaign to put the Palestinian flag up onto council building. So he was really a person with a breadth of compassion and concern, and dedicated really all his life to people. I mean, one of the funniest anecdotes, and we've been reflecting on Gaetano, is that other, you know, so-called progressive parties one time approached him and said, well, how do you campaign? How do you get the voice of the people? And that was a sort of unheard of concept to him, because it seemed so easy for him. He just talked to the people. He just get out there and knock on doors and talk to people. And it didn't matter whether his principles were grounded in communism. The important thing was what those principles led him to. So if people need garbage collected, lights on, streets fixed so you don't fall into a pothole, that's where the interest is, and that's how you balance doing the bigger stuff as well.
One of the things that's really important about this too that strikes me is that, you know, when you see places that are named after people in local environments, I always think, because having a historical mind, I'm thinking, I wonder who that person was. And it leaves you to look into that person, which is important, because actually naming the library, which I have to say, the library is such a perfect a place to have his name, because, of course, that's what libraries represent. But it's not for Gaetano, it's for us.
Yeah. It creates a bit of a living link to people that really existed and that did real work in the community, and that's really important to remember. And I think that's one of the most important bits about the Reservoir Library being renamed there after Gaetano, because one, he was a resident of Northcote, Preston Reservoir. His work was always around there, but also the thing about the library is that it stands at this perfect nexus of things that represent what Gaetano was about. So empowering people for their own self-determination, providing education there, providing access to services. Because, I mean, like we've often said, you've often told me, Annie, you know, the library is so much more than just a place where you can get books. It's a place where people can be connected in a very real way to services that they might not ever be able to access on their own.
Yeah, and they can actually be comfortable.
That's right. And not feel judged and stuff like that. So that's a lot of the reasons why we're pointing on this, and it's not just us doing it of our own volition. We've been given the mandate by his family. And so, yeah, that's all. We just want to encourage people to get out there and write an email, and if you want to come talk to us, we'll be there from about 11 onwards.
That's tomorrow. That's at Reservoir Library. And
right, that's the Reservoir train station.
Yeah, and go to the Darabin Council offices. What address is that?
That's on High Street. It escapes me exactly when.
But it's in High Street. In
it's
North
on High Street, yeah.
At 6, for the council meeting at 6:30 on Tuesday.
Yeah, perfect.
All right. Thanks very much for waking up and telling us that.
No stress. Thank you so much to all the listeners, and thank you guys for a great program. I'll talk to you guys later.
Ciao. Ciao. That's 284 Gower Street, folks. 284 Gower Street, Preston, where the Town Hall is.
A weak Solidarity Bricky team listener, when a totally neutral, other than Caesar rendering under Caesar, investigation by Zion Train Killers into Zion Train Killers found Zion Train Killers had not killed those 7 World Central Kitchen workers. They were killed by Hamas terrorists. Indeed, misunderstood Zion, accused of slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation, is completely innocent on all charges. Okay, it does drop the bombs. It did incinerate the convoy taking aid to the destroyed and starved. It was too late for the slaughtered, but be it Gaza or the West Bank or Lebanon, well, all of Zion, from the river to the sea, it only slaughters and destroys and bombs and starves because it suspects Hamas or Hezbollah or terrorists of some sort or other are in that building or that convoy, because the terrorists are just everywhere. And anyway, the so-called collateral damage, thousands and thousands of civilians, are also potential terrorists. In fact, they're all terrorists. So poor misunderstood Zion is never responsible. And it was pure coincidence that Zion was forced to lay the blame solely with evil Hamas on World Humanitarian Day, as our minister for going overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, Penny Left Wing, launched the Zomi Francom Humanitarian Award. After all, there is every chance there were True Blue Aussie parts in the killer planes which launched the bombs. They're the parts Penny and Big Supremo Anthony Albanese and the Minister for Train Killing and Being Offensive Richard Moores, the bad guys, he of the giant mind, assure us we are not providing. And Zion pointed out the convoy had changed the route Zion Train Killers had approved, given permission, and we wouldn't doubt the word of the most moral train killer force in the world, as Big Supremo Benu and Not Another Yahoo reminds us time and again. Although getting permission to provide aid to the starving in Gaza from an invasion force, just think, they wouldn't need permission if, wait for it, I'm going to say something very, very naive, if the Zion train killers weren't there in the first place. Naive, because that's their right, from the river to the sea and beyond and beyond. Petty, you're not suggesting that Zion is the real terrorist after all, are you? Of course not. Zion is a democracy. True Blue Aussie recognises evil Hamas as a terrorist organisation. Another slaughterer is obviously what's laughably called an election of some sort coming up in Russia, as a Vlad you put in, I take out opponent has been jailed for 11 years hard labour over some online criticism of Vlad, opposing Vlad's Ukraine invasion, or sorry, military operation, and an opposition party has been banned from running on the sensible legal grounds that it was considering running. And then, most heinous, most treacherous, most perfidious crime of all, Andrei Klepak, real name, chief economist at the state-owned bank, told an economic meeting the Ukraine war, or sorry again, military operation, is plunging the country into a social crisis. We're falling behind, he warned. We're losing to Ukraine. The costs we bear are mounting. his final act as chief economist, immediately sacked after his bank superiors received, quote, a call from above. Didn't say who the from above was, so we've got no idea, but across the divide, past the US of the UN of the US of the world state of Greenland, big supremo Donald Trump or the poor looked on with growing admiration, declaring all possible opposition ineligible and locking them up as the best guarantee of winning, the biggest winning ever, as Donald practiced the art of trashing democracy. His appropriately named Truth Social Nocturnal Ravings, or sorry, Big Supremo Pronouncements, selling early access to his pronouncements for just $1.7 million a year. We might have thought it worth paying to avoid them, but a couple of anti-democratic types have challenged Donald's little money-making scheme in court as unconstitutional. Something about the First Amendment guaranteeing equal access to Big Supremo announcements. And how's this for sour grapes, listener? A Big Supremo selling priority access to news he himself generates for the benefit of a private company he controls is so blatantly corrupt and unconstitutional, it would have been hard to even fathom just a few years ago. A mob called the Freedom of the Press Foundation complained. Where are they coming from? The naivety of those comments evident. Note the split infinitive in the middle of all that nonsense. For goodness sake, what's the use of being Big Supremo if you can't make a few little or more billions out of it? And your cronies and your family can't make a nice little killing out of it as well. Some of the cronies literally making a killing out of killing. Donald's Nobel Quest. Quite properly, Trample the Poor Media said the lawsuit was an attempt by left-wing activists trying to censor poor, well, getting richer and richer, Donald. Commented last week, our junior train killing and being offensive minister Pat Military Convoy was put in his place by the Pentagon policy supremo Eldridge Kill by All Means when Pat reckoned US of train killers and train killer submarines rotating through Western Troop to Aussie would be out in 5 years. We're here to stay, Eldridge set him straight. They're here to stay. Pat got his orders, his lines right. Well, now Eldridge tells us he has made it very clear in private what is expected of Troubler Aussie under the onomatopoeic forecast agreement. Presumably, keep handing US of merchants of death billions for the US of in return, not providing anything, including the train killer nuclear underwater thingies you'll never see. While the number one minister for train killing and being offensive, the aforementioned Richard Mauls the bad guys, he of the giant mind, said permanent US of train killer rotations in Western Troubler Aussie are really important and will enable Troubler Aussie to establish our own capability, which could have done with a bit of an explanation. As US of so-called think tank, the Heritage Foundation called on True Blue Aussie to spend even more billions to buy missile interceptors from the US of merchants of death, needed, it said, to protect the air base in Darwin and the Western True Blue Aussie nuclear killer submarine HMAS Stirling Idea. So you demand we spend billions to protect US of marines in Darwin and train killers in Western and True Blue Aussie. Exactly. It's a full price for the protection you are enjoying. But they could make us a target. That's why you need our protection. Well, that's cleared that up. Not totally unrelated, reports from Gippsland of, sorry, the enforcers of law and order perpetrating violence, assaulting suspects, suspected of being a terra nullius non-land, non-person, for instance. Coppers being violent, not sure that's news, actually. With the first ever charge against a copper over use of a taser, convicted on 10 assault charges just because he doused a young bloke in the face with capsicum spray and tasered him a mere 9 times in 46 seconds. He copped a fine, or coppered a fine, and is currently suspended, but surely he must be reinstated. Our forces of law and order can't afford to lose such a dedicated officer. There have been 2,365 allegations of misconduct and corruption by coppers in the Morwell-Bairnsdale regions, and a massive 0.2% were investigated. Well, that's what police do, investigate. Still, the dedication to stamp out suspects, perhaps literally, obviously stems from the top, as the number one oink oink, sorry copper, Mike Bash this week, called for less bail, more jail for the lowlifes. Lowlifes. They deserve a bit of capsicum spraying, tasering, kicking, bashing. Oh, and very, very sad news. Former airline, which used to be our airline supremo, Alan Joystick, that great friend of airline workers, Alan Joystick's self-promoting autobiography is still not moving. As one bookseller commented, people aren't beating down the door to get a copy. Hard to understand, listener. Once again, also hard to understand for we economic laity, unlike the experts who comprehend the intricacies of the delicate flower that is the economy, figures this week that workers had fallen further behind, that an annual increase of 3.2% in wages fell behind inflation. Despite caring employers telling us the small rise for the lowest of low paid would destroy the economy, smash confidence, deter investment, obliterate certainty, those important ingredients which will lead sometime, they'll tell us when, a wage rise will not destroy the world as we know it. Wage rises always occur at the wrong time. Well, despite workers falling behind, caring employers this week said wage inflation is driving up costs. Goodness, imagine the disaster if there were real wage increases. And although there are more unemployed doing their bit for the economy, the Reserve Losses Bank said there weren't quite enough to guarantee interest rates might not have to rise. See, the problem is on the other side. There are too many people working. Selfish, unpatriotic, economic vandals. And it's not that caring employers don't care. One large residential village developer complained that government taxes on property are hurting the poorest 40% of households who can only afford about 10% of advertised rentals. See? Good, compassionate developer. Oh, and on developers, this His Most Gracious Majesty's con mission into the evil CFMEU. Developers, property industry, be careful what you wish for. Past con missions aimed at the evil unions have ended up nailing the poor caring employers. Finally, headline this week, public backlash at decisive risk for data centres. How dare the public risk profits? Although, we might even reverse it. Data centres are decisive risk for public. Oh, we are so naive this morning, aren't we? Good morning.
Good morning, Kevin. What a brilliant This Is The Week that was this week. You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Matt, and we're going to go quickly because we've got very little time, but we've got a couple of speeches that were delivered at a recent new international bookshop, NIBS event. They did it in collaboration with the with Arena, and it was we're doing it as part of Science Week, celebrating Science Week and 3CR Breakfast AI specials. It's all about AI and it's all about how it affects work, and here are a couple of opinions.
Chris O'Neill is a lecturer in media in the School of Media, Film and Journalism at Monash University. He draws upon critical media theory and science and technology studies to investigate the way the human body is measured and mediated through technology. He's especially concerned with the social and political implications of facial recognition technology, biometric sensing, and emerging forms of automation. His first book, Cultural Techniques of Biosensing, A History of the Body in Error, will be published with Stanford University Press in September 2026. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you. Okay, so AI and work. I guess, you know, really the big question, or the question everyone's worried about, is will AI lead to job losses or even some sort of like employment or labor apocalypse. It's important not to be either too blasé or too doomy here. I think AI will be implicated in job losses, at least to some degree, but I think this will be an uneven and highly contingent process and that it's easy to lose sight of this. So the example here from a few weeks ago of 9 newspapers cutting jobs at The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald due to extreme AI disruption and quote-unquote evolution. Now, the obvious interpretation that I think one would be has been primed to take from this kind of headline is that these job losses are because journalists are being fired because they've become superfluous in an age in which AI can just sort of write the news itself now. The actual justification, even given by Nine themselves for the job losses, is that Google's AI summaries of the news now mean that people aren't clicking through to actual news websites anymore, which is a further sort of knife in the revenues of news organizations. Now, is this a jobs apocalypse? Right? No, I don't mean to be flippant about it. Certainly, those job losses, it's bad news. Certainly, I know journalists are being pressured increasingly to use AI in their journalism roles, but that's not the same as saying that AI will simply be able to automate the work of journalism to core. Let's take another recent example. So this is a case of an HR consultant who paid £400 in England to use a platform called Garfield AI to pursue and win a case over an unpaid claim of £7,000 in an English county court. Per The Guardian's story, I quote, "The AI conducted all the legal work preceding the trial, which involved disputing a counterclaim launched by the defendant, against the plaintiff, who instructed solicitors. The AI prepared 4 witness statements and a bundle of documents for the 3-hour trial at Wandsworth County Court on 14th of May, and the court found in favor of the plaintiff and awarded her the money owed." This is kind of a landmark. It's the first time like an AI lawyer has won a case, right? So now there's been a lot of panic amongst lawyers that these kinds of platforms are going to, run riot through especially smaller or suburban law firms and junior roles. And I'm sure maybe they will. Again, I don't want to give any impression that I'm being sort of optimistic. I'm not optimistic. But if we take things at, a sort of broader level here, what has in fact happened, right? So in this case, right, these kinds of small claims are notoriously difficult to pursue, given that the costs of doing so often approach the amounts being sought after, so they're often very high risk for the plaintiff, right? So rather than automating work, this is probably producing more work, right? This case may very well have simply never happened otherwise, or may have been settled out of court or whatever. In this case, real human solicitors still needed to be hired to pursue the case in court, and a real human judge still had to pass judgment, something which I would argue cannot ultimately be automated, given the need for judgment to be predicated upon the responsibility which an embodied human must tarry with. It also, compelled more work from the injured party herself, the work of gathering the evidence and prompting the Gen AI platform, which she obviously would not otherwise have done. So at least in this case, I would say Gen AI is producing rather than eliminating work. It's also interesting because it is to some degree empowering for the plaintiff, insofar as it encourages and organizes their identity as a rational economic agent. But this is, of course, a further intrusion upon their free time, i.e., again, it is more rather than less work. Right? Both of these cases involve the automation of work by AI, but the circumstances and outcomes are as variable as the nature of work itself. Again, this is not a cause for optimism, but it shows that we must think closely about what we're talking about when we talk about AI and work. To a significant degree, the term AI is, I would suggest, holding together an immense variety of technological and ideological claims, which, upon investigation, are riven by the kinds of contradiction and chaos which characterize capital itself. And this, I think, is what's important. It means that while there's no cause for optimism, but the prospect of a jobs apocalypse is, I would argue, as remote as the prospect of the end of capitalism itself. You know, in fact, it would, you know, actually demand the end of capitalism. What I think is more likely to happen is that AI will contribute to something like what the French philosopher of technology Bernard Stiegler referred to as proletarianization, or what people like Harry Braverman in his analysis of Taylorism would have recognized as de-skilling. That is to say, I think an increasing range of workplace demands will become automated, but this won't lead to us needing to work any less per se. Instead, we will find, I think, that AI erodes the capacity for worker autonomy. Work will become increasingly organized around meeting the demands of AI to filling in the gaps of AI, while at the same time the ideological force of AI will function as a significant disciplinary tool in the hands of employers, right? You better do it or we're going to automate your job, right? Of course, many examples of this having already taken place in more or less recent labor history, but it's a process that's more typically associated with blue-collar rather than white-collar work. Even here, though, the effects of automation have been uneven and contingent. When the logistics giant Amazon arrived in Australia a few years ago, there were, for example, understandable anxieties that it would introduce the kind of inhuman neo-Taylorist demands on workers that would lead to situations such as we've heard of happening with Amazon overseas. Horror stories of workers being compelled to work to an inhumanly fast pace such that they needed to urinate in the aisles at the warehouse rather than take toilet breaks just to keep up with their demands. But in fact, the neo-Taylorist revolution already came to pass in Australia about 35 years ago in warehousing following the rise of the management philosophy known as engineered standards, which was introduced into Australian grocery warehousing in the early 90s during the Accord era, and which a now largely forgotten New South Wales Industrial Relations Commission investigation found was indeed increasing pressure on pick rates to the extent that employees were needing to urinate in the aisles to make up their times. Now, the point is that it didn't take any particularly advanced computational technique to drive this pressure and abuse of employees, only a particularly ruthless kind of management ideology. Indeed, the true innovation of Amazon when it did arrive in Australia was not any particular technological advance, but a breathtaking innovation in the use of third-party labour hire. When it opened warehouses in Australia during the late 2010s, some Amazon warehouses were apparently entirely staffed with casual labour hire employees. And this arrangement was unprecedented in Australian industrial relations history, and further weakened the capacity for Australian unions, obviously, to defend workers, since the staff did not have a direct employment relation with Amazon. It meant that my main point then would be that certainly AI is a danger for workers and will surely play a part in the disciplining of workers and the reduction of their autonomy in the workplace. But again, that this is a contingent and a politically fraught process. Moreover, that we can look to past struggles for lessons on how to resist this process, and that workers should, I think, be wary of attributing a coherence to AI or its other avatars, algorithmic management and so on, that there is some sort of telos of AI as straightforwardly destroying jobs, which would belie the way in which AI's impact on the world of work will be, I think, as fraught and as riven by contradictions as capitalism always has been.
Isn't that fantastic? You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Matt, and I just had this image of, of oligarch grifters flying like the magic monkeys from The Wizard of Oz, you know, coming down, preying on us, because we've all been fooled into believing that they're more important than life itself. Anyway, that was Chris O'Neill, part of the NIBS Arena event at NIBS recently. And this is even better. This is Tim Strong. Listen to this. He was at the same event.
Now we're going to hear from Tim Strong. Tim is an Arena Publications editor and is finishing up a postdoctoral research fellowship looking at the extinction crisis. His next book, Cybernetic Capitalism, was commissioned by Verso and will hopefully be out mid next year. Thanks, Tim.
I'm going to start with a similar kind of move, actually, in going back historically and saying, oh, things, this has been in train for a long time. It's not just since 2022. I'll start what I want to say with, in my favorite place to start a lot of these discussions, which is at a very specific moment. Back in 1945, there were three moments, a kind of triptych, which have the names Trinity, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. Those three bombs and the opening of nuclear power and what that entailed, I think, is a really threshold moment that underpins a lot of what we're seeing right now. AI has the same genesis as the atomic projects. They were bound together from the beginning in weird kinds of ways. It's just to get to where we are now has a longer chain reaction than the splitting of atoms. Back then, the US Secretary of War, Stinton was his name, he said very accurately shortly after the Trinity test, he said, this test is not just reveals not just about the bombs and new weapons, but it actually reveals a new relationship humanity has with the universe. And I think he was absolutely right. The Secretary of War nailed it. And what they did by dropping those three bombs, they were tests. They didn't know what would happen exactly. Would they destroy the entire planet that was actually on the cards? How would it work? In effect, what they did by doing that was turned the world into a kind of laboratory. And a laboratory where you can have these unhinged experiments that are just thrown out into the world. Laboratory is an interesting word. It comes from the Latin. Ultimately, it shares the same root origin as the word labor. So then I guess the question is, okay, what kind of labor happens in a laboratory when you turn the whole world into a kind of a lab? And the answer is a bit of a typical arena one for anyone familiar with that publication. It's a kind of intellectual labor. And the kind of intellectual labor that can piece something together like an atomic bomb or the actual machinery that can create artificial intelligence to actually bring that into being and make it a material force in the world, it requires a huge amount of highly abstract intellectual labor. And if you trace the origins of that, that labor did not emerge from the history of labor larger or the history of craft or any of the other traditions of how things came into being. It came specifically from the military-industrial complex, and it was very rapidly turned directly against craft and labor more largely. And I think it's curious to note that the radical tradition hasn't actually got a good grasp of that in a lot of ways. Whereas on the other side, the centers of power, they were very keen observers of that. I just quoted the US Secretary of War from World War II. Also back in 1945, Vannevar Bush, is another great character. He was the first scientific advisor to any US president, and he wrote this incredible paper, which then became a book called Science, the Endless Frontier, in 1945, taking that lovely colonial metaphor. And in it, he argued that the military-industrial complex, for it to be powerful in the world, it needs huge amounts of highly trained intellectuals to do research. Through that basic research is the key to victory in war, national defense, industrial production increasing, consumer society increasing. He nailed it. The report is amazing, actually, in terms of its foresight. And reading, going back to it, you're like, wow, they had a very strong grasp of the key role that intellectuals played in this process, which is a different kind of labor from what we think about often when we think labor. As I said, back in 1945, you had those three explosions. A completely different relationship with the universe began opening up, but it took quite a while for the broader chain reaction of that to get to where we are now, three human generations later, more or less. And a lot has shifted. Back in 1945, when all those bombs were first dropped, computer was not a machine that you would type on. It was a job, actually. The job computer came about 500 years ago with the first surveys, scientific surveys of land in order to enclose the commons. And a computer's job was to go and do the calculations required to figure out the area of different parts of the commons that were being carved up. And then later they would do other kind of calculative work. It was a profession. And it wasn't until the creation of computing machines that that job went completely obsolete. And it ended up being replaced. Now the term, it's kind of, there's a dark irony in the word computer, because itself is a case of a job being obsolete and outsourced to a machine. And then if we jump forward to today's world, a key thing is this looming specter of a kind of jobs apocalypse, which has already been raised. Will this be a thing? I tend to agree with Chris in that I suspect, even though there will be very sharp job losses in a number of key areas, undoubtedly, and there already are, and this will deepen as the years go by, most likely, but a big part of it will also be a sort of a reconstitution of what is work, and a lot of it will be a kind of bullshitification, if that could be a word, to sort of draw on Graeber's concept of bullshit jobs. Like, so many jobs, and not even just work, but so much of life is now pulled through these sort of systems that, have the effect of undermining and hollowing out, you know, caregiving or education or thinking or journalism or any of those things that are probably, on a bit of reflection, probably fairly important, probably worth, thinking through. But then if you look at a lot of the major reports on these kinds of things, like I was looking at a big IMF study the other day, and it was claiming that 40% of jobs will be transformed globally within the next 5 or so years by AI, 60% in the rich world. And, they're probably right, but what does transformed mean? And they don't specify that. And then they will say, inequality will get worse, but with good and proper management, everyone could be a winner. And they have this sort of lame line like that. But then that lame line gets echoed by various radicals who say, the problem is this a management thing. If only we could do it in the favor of workers, then everything would be happily ever after. And I think that that's pretty instrumental in its setup. And it takes this sort of double-edged sword and says, technology can be great, but it can also be bad. And it's not a very fruitful place to then start thinking about where we actually are and what this actually means in any kind of deeper way. I think, to come at a more critical accounts of cybernetics and technosciences, we need to not collapse back to sort of 19th century style class structures. Today, of course, we have far greater concentrated ownership and far greater inequality that has ever existed at any point, period. The distance between, say, a Jeff Bezos and a worker in an Amazon factory is orders of magnitude greater in terms of wealth than the difference between a pharaoh and a slave. They're so much further apart now, it's not even funny. So those things are very real. Yet, I keep putting class exploitation, uberalis, over any other kind of way of looking at things actually does a bit of a disservice to getting into some of the different lines that we have running through the world today. We need a more expansive kind of historical materialism, and one that can also begin to encompass the web of life itself. Lucy mentioned that I'm just finishing up a postdoctoral research fellowship on the rather sunny question of extinction. And unfortunately, that line of work crosses over with this line of work a little more than I would like it to in a number of ways. Just one key little factoid on that kind of a line. Back in 2022, the UN released a major publication about e-waste. And in that, they concluded that just in the year 2022, there was 62 million tons of e-waste produced globally. I'm like, that's a lot. But what is 62 million tons of e-waste? To try to visualize that, just as one little slice into the sort of ecological consequences of this world that we've created, 62 million tons, it's about the same weight as about 100,000, what are they, A380 aircrafts. You know those things? They're the two-story aircrafts. They can fit 850 people in them. They're absolutely gargantuan. They're like the biggest thing we've ever made fly. Well, if you get 100,000 of them and line them up, tail to nose, and form an unbroken queue from Melbourne to Nagasaki. That is the amount of e-waste as was produced in 2022 alone. This is absolutely mind-boggling. Another way to put the same statistic is if you were to get that e-waste and put it in standard garbage trucks, it would, the amount of garbage trucks you would need would be a line, again, tail to nose, 40,000 kilometres, which is neatly the circumference of the Earth at the equator. And that's in 1 year. And that was before the AI boom, where we've had this absolutely gargantuan investment in all of this kind of stuff. It was back in 2022, NVIDIA, its market capitalization was only about 500 billion. Now it's 5 trillion. This is orders of magnitude of this sort of demented curve that we're on. Anyway, suffice to say, the habitability of our planet is in question. And this needs to be a clear focus on any kind of good critical theory, critical journalism, any kind of historical materialism worth its salt. And we have to look at what's different and what's new. And I guess to wrap up, in this world that we've created to be a kind of a laboratory, what kind of a kind of uncontrolled experiment, really, we need to look at what labor means today, what is work. And a key part of this, a key locus of power, is in this intellectual work, and to try to make sense of that. Because since it has been so closely bound up in service of the military and the market, it has remade the whole human condition in all kinds of, not just the human condition, but the entire biosphere, really. And I could provide a long, arbitrary list of different things that are reorganized by this. But yeah, basically it cuts, it creates the conditions of a cut so deep into what it means to be human and what it means to live in our world today that we can only really talk about it as a transformation in being. And I think that that's a pretty crucial entry point to try to kick some of these ideas around. I guess I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.